Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. This is Veronica Monet, your host with the Shame-Free Zone. And we've got a little departure from format tonight. Usually I interview a guest. I will be doing that again at some point in time. However, I'm going to be doing a little bit different program in the long term. And the reason that I want to do this is because I want to develop a dialogue between you, my listeners, and myself. And I think the best way to do that is to tell you a little bit about myself. And I'm going to do that for about the first half hour of this program, and then I'm going to actually turn to some real live questions that clients and would-be clients have emailed to me of questions about sex, questions about relationship, questions about shame. Just a sample, actually, if you are online and you're looking at the Shame Free Zone page right now, you can see some of those questions are, I'm horny, but want to go to heaven, help. I'm suffering from premature ejaculation. Please, can you help me get rid of this problem? How can I satisfy a woman sexually? That's a pretty common one. I'm having difficulty letting go of whatever still holds my body incapable of orgasm through cunnilingus. That came from a woman, obviously. And last year, my boyfriend cheated on me. He did not tell me. And from there, things got worse. Well, I'm assuming that he didn't stop lying. But anyway, before I get into those, let me tell you a little bit about me. I've been interviewing people here on the Shame Free Zone now since June, and hopefully you have enjoyed hearing my various illustrious guests' stories and their commentary. Most of our topics have been sexual in nature. But the one thing you really haven't gotten is a chance to hear anything about me, and the reason I want you to know about me is so that we can start building a little bit of trust. I've been saying this all along, that your secret is safe with me, and this is a good place for you to call in for your questions. But it occurs to me that you don't really know who I am, so you might wonder why you would care what I had to say about your particular relationship or sexual issues. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. Got a pretty controversial past, but before I get into that, we'll go all the way back to the childhood. I grew up in a very dysfunctional working class family. It was a right-wing Christian, and I don't have anything against Christianity, but I myself at this point in my adult life am not associated with any particular religious affiliation, and I kind of prefer it that way. But anyway, read the Bible from cover to cover when I was 12 years old, and really wanted to have that spiritual awakening that I thought would come once I finished reading the Bible. It took me 1 year to do it. I read a little bit of the Bible every day for an entire year, and when I finished, I was really proud of myself, but I wasn't feeling really close to God, and I wasn't having a spiritual awakening, and wasn't feeling filled with the Holy Ghost. As a matter of fact, I actually felt a little nauseous, like I was going to throw up. So I was pretty convinced at that point that I must really be the demon seed or the daughter of Satan, because no good Christian worth their salt would have that kind of a physiological response to reading the Bible. My mother read the Bible every day, and she was pretty happy. She found it to be inspiring and comforting and soothing. That was not my response at all. In retrospect, I realized there was a lot of sexual shame in the pages of the Bible, and most of it was directed towards women and women's bodies, and I think that's why I had such a physiologically violent reaction against the information in those pages. It was just really hard for me to see the love because I saw so much hatred towards women. I went on a search after that, and most of it took me to drugs and alcohol, and I did go to college. I majored in psychology at Oregon State University and graduated with I was an honors student, so I graduated with honors. I had an honors at entrance, honors at graduation, and I tutored English the whole time I was in college. So a little bit nerdy, but not really, because I had this drug and alcohol problem. Somehow or another, I managed to keep those grades up while I was studying. And I used to make deals with myself, basically. It was like, okay, read 300 pages, and then you can have a quart of beer. So, and I would just chug it and pass out. Anyway, by the time I was 21, I had my first drinking-related arrest. I went to jail in Sparks, Nevada, for having sex in public. I had had a bunch of Brandy Alexanders, and I was out playing pool with a bartender from Harrah's Casino. That's where I was working. It was a summer job. And we got really, really drunk. And so drunk, we didn't know where we were, and we didn't know what we were doing. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. We were parked right in front of a Mervyn's, and they were having a sale that day. So the people were waiting for the doors to open, just like in the advertisements. There were mothers and fathers and their little kids. And there I and the older bartender were, with our pants down in broad daylight at 10 o'clock in the morning, having a very unsuccessful attempt at consummating our association in the front seat of his car. So we got arrested, and I was very, very, very angry. I thought, boy, I'm in the only state in the union where prostitution is illegal, and or is legal, but I get arrested for giving it away. And I thought that was ironic. Anyway, I almost got a felony out of that, believe it or not. They wanted to throw the book at me, and a lot of that was because I had a bad attitude. I wrote on the jail cell wall and was really belligerent. So I was really lucky, got a good attorney, and got off on a misdemeanor, and I didn't have to register as a sex offender, but I would have if I hadn't had a good attorney, which is just unbelievable when you think about it. Sex offenders, you usually think about those as people who molest kids or rape somebody, not consensual sex taking place in a car, but such is the law in some places. So I went back to college, I graduated, and then I moved to California, and I started working in corporate America, and that lasted for 7 years. And during that time, I worked in office jobs. I was an office manager for one company, and I was a department manager for another company. So it was all white-collar jobs. I got awards. I got promotions. I did fairly well, even though I was still having a drinking and drugging problem. I was always a very high achiever. So I managed to hold it together for a few years out of college. And then the bottom fell out on that. I lost my job and got picked up for a DUI. And I was living with my coke dealer at the time. And our relationship had turned extremely violent. So there was pretty much somebody, a paramedic, a police officer, or somebody with badges and sirens at our door almost every weekend for, I don't know, a couple of months. It was pretty hellacious. And I ended up going to a therapist and asking him to help me. I said, I don't know what's wrong with my life. And he said, lady, you're an alcoholic. And if you don't get, if you're not ready to deal with the alcoholism, then I can't help you. Now, I was all of 24, maybe just barely turned 25. And I was pretty upset that anybody would talk that way to me. I was a college graduate, and I had an apartment, and I drove a car, and I lived, in a nice neighborhood, and at the time, I still actually had my job, so I thought, how dare he? How dare he call me an alcoholic? So I went home to prove him wrong, and for 30 days, I did not have a single drink, and I was so proud of myself, and I had to go celebrate by getting drunk. Anyway, the rest is history. My life continued to have a downward spiral, and I ended up in the rooms of 12-step recovery. So I started going to these 12-step meetings, and got sober. And at that time, found a new roommate, had to get rid of the old boyfriend. And he stalked me. I thought maybe he was going to kill me at one point. I was very, very afraid of him. But eventually, he took up with another woman and lost interest in me, and I went on to have a clean and sober life for the next 4 years, and I met a woman who was a prostitute. And at that time, I was a marketing representative for a radio station, ironically enough. And when I met this woman, I was actually having a coming-out experience as a bisexual woman. So I was realizing that I was bisexual, and I was having a lot of problems with that because I'd just gotten sober, and I was still trying to go back to that whole Christian white picket fence thing. I was really thinking finally I was going to be the daughter my mother always wanted, and I'd get my life together, and I'd be good. I'd finally be good. But, my sexuality had something else in mind, and I really, really thought that those couple times I'd had sex with a girl at college, I thought that was because I got drunk and I was just experimenting. So I did not expect to come out. That was the last thing I wanted, and it was the last thing that I thought was going to happen. But it had like a mind of its own, and pretty soon I was going to gay meetings, and I couldn't understand why, and I was hanging out with gay people, and I really was resentful about it. And eventually I came to terms with the fact that I was in fact bisexual, and I got involved in a bisexual movement. As a matter of fact, started writing for the first and only national bisexual magazine. I was the staff writer for that magazine for 5 years. It's called Anything That Moves. It's out of circulation now, but it was actually an item of conversation on the Dennis Miller Show years and years ago. So we got a little bit of publicity. About this time, when I was starting to come to terms with being bisexual, is when I met Heather. And Heather was a married mother of three, and she also happened to be a prostitute. This was really mind-blowing for me because everything I'd seen on TV and everything I'd read in my college textbooks all pointed to the fact that prostitutes were drug addicts, their lives were incredibly dysfunctional, and most of them had pimps. And all this stuff, and so then I meet this woman. She lives in a nice suburb in a beautiful two-story home with a husband who's also got a managerial job in the IBM area. He wasn't necessarily working for IBM, but they lived in the IBM area of San Jose. And she's got three kids, and she drives a little Mercedes, and she's a health nut. She works out 6 days a week. I've never, ever seen her even finish one glass of wine, let alone have an alcohol problem, and she's never done drugs in her entire life. So she really blew my mind. I was like, who is this woman? So now I'm 4 years sober, and I meet this lady, and it was pretty much lust at sight, first sight. We started dating, yes, even though she was married. She was in an open marriage, and I was single. I wasn't with anybody at the time. So I pretty much fell head over heels. And we started having a pretty hot and heavy sex life. And I got to know her very intimately on a lot of different levels. And the thing that really struck me about her was just how happy she was. She was happy, she was healthy, and she was really in charge of her life. So her husband, you know, did not tell her what to do in any way, shape, or form. She was just an amazingly empowered businesswoman. So it wasn't long before I started comparing her job and my job, and I'm still going to, you know, this radio station. I got men who are saying, oh, I signed with your competitor months ago. The only reason I was continuing to let you come out here and pitch us for ad time is because I was hoping you'd go out to dinner with me. And I was working for 10% commission and having to deal with people who really wanted something else. And I remembered something in business school where they say, if the market wants a particular product, that's what you should be selling. You shouldn't, like, go out and manufacture spoons when the world wants forks. And I thought, this is interesting. I'm out here trying to sell airtime, but people want me. Now, I would not have made this big leap if it hadn't been for the girlfriend, but she had normalized it for me. I mean, I thought, wow, okay. This might be something worth checking out. So I had some fear because, you know, prostitution is illegal in every state but Rhode Island and Nevada. Rhode Island, you've got to do it indoors, but they won't prosecute you. And in Nevada, you have to be in a legal brothel or they will put you in jail. But anyway, those are the only two places in the United States where it's legal. There's countries in other parts of the world where it's legal, but in the U.S., that's it. So anyway, you know, I'm living in the state of California where it's illegal, and I certainly had some fear about that. But my girlfriend agreed to teach me the job. Now, I would like you to listen to that. I had a college degree, a four-year college degree. I had a Bachelor of Science in Psychology, a minor in Business Administration. I was, I graduated with 3.65, something like that, tutored English, worked 7 years in corporate America, was mostly in management or marketing positions, had people working for me and under me, and, you know, had gotten awards and things like that. So what on earth could a prostitute have to teach me, you might wonder? Well, she had plenty to teach me. First and foremost, she conducted herself as a small business, so she taught me how to conduct myself as an entrepreneur with a sole proprietorship. I had the foggiest how you did that, and I went down and I got a fictitious business name and filed it in the paper like you're supposed to, and I started paying quarterly taxes. So that was the first thing she taught me, and the second thing she taught me was that have to learn not only how to use a condom properly, but you want to use it in a way that's really hot. Because if it's not erotic, people aren't going to pay big bucks to see you, and they're not going to come back. So there's a lot of skill and technique that goes into that. And then the third thing she taught me was how to screen my phone calls. Mostly, you know, it wasn't bad people that called us. Very rarely did you get calls from people who were out to hurt you. But you could screen out the people that were going to be annoying in some way, or perhaps didn't have the money and were going to be bargaining money when they got there. So you learn how to look for those sort of things. But most importantly, we were screening for vice cops. Because really, to tell you the truth, if you're an indoor prostitute, that's your biggest fear, is just in vice cops. So I always think that's kind of ironic because they think their mission in life is to protect us, and, you know, we pretty much see them as people who are out to degrade us. So, and live off of our money. But I'll tell you more about that later. Okay, so I apprenticed to this woman for 9 months, and then I went out on my own. I moved to San Francisco, and I started working in calls and out calls. In calls is where you go to somebody's apartment or hotel or house. And out calls, I'm sorry, I have just the opposite. In calls is where they come to you. Out calls is where you go to them. So I wasn't doing a lot of in calls. I was kind of afraid to let people come to my apartment. Did a lot of out calls. Those tended to be traveling businessmen and then young single guys. So that was my demographic, and most of them were really nice people. Really, you know, every once in a while I'd run into somebody who had personality difficulties or maybe a drinking problem or something like that. But for the most part, these are just like average, normal kind of guys that I might have dated when I was in college. And it really didn't feel much different to me than dating, except that I was finally getting paid for it. So anyway, when I started doing in-calls, that became a different demographic. These became a lot of local married men, and then I started realizing that the married men wanted daytime hours. So, because they had to get home before their wives and girlfriends found out what they were doing. So, that was interesting. And I didn't really like working with the married men so much because I didn't like the idea that they were lying and cheating. But, it was in some ways better money because you didn't have to travel around so much and drive so much. And you could see more people in the course of a day. So, and therefore you could keep your rates more reasonable instead of having to charge people for travel time. So, anyway, there were trade-offs for that. But from there, I ended up getting engaged, and then I got married, and I actually became a married woman who was working as an escort by about the second year that I was working as an escort. So, and I worked from the fall of 1989 to January of 2004. That's quite a long time. Obviously, I really loved it. I stayed with escorting longer than I've done anything else in my life. And for most of those years, I was happily married. And we did eventually get divorced, but we didn't get divorced until I had left escorting. So it's interesting because a lot of people would have thought that escorting would have broken up our marriage, and it's not true. I made a decision to change my life and move, change a lot of things. So I moved away, and I really, really wanted to write a book, and that's what I did. I wrote a sex manual, and it's called Veronica Monet's Sex Secrets of Escorts. And it was published through Alpha Books in the year 2005, and now I am getting ready to release my memoir, which won't be a sex manual, and it won't be a how-to. It's going to be more of what I'm telling you tonight, only in much more detail. So, the marriage. A lot of people always wanted to know, was your husband jealous? Was he bothered? And, oh, of course. As a matter of fact, when he first proposed, I agreed to quit prostitution. I couldn't even envision being married as a prostitute. I thought that those two things couldn't possibly happen at the same time. It seemed very sacrilegious to me. And then my girlfriend, not the other one that was already married, but one of my close girlfriends who was also sober, also clean and sober, she got married just before I did, and she continued to work. And I remember thinking, well, why would I quit my job? And then, of course, I thought back about Heather and how she was married when I met her, and why wouldn't, you know, why did I assume that I had to quit my job? That's not very feminist of me. So I went and told my fiancé, I'm really sorry, but there's just no way that I want to change my career. And there's no way that I want to quit my job. And frankly, to put it bluntly, there's no way I want to live off of your income, because I was making about twice what he was. So he was very upset. I told him if he wanted to call off the marriage, I would understand. And I thought he was going to there for a little bit, and then he decided not to. And we got married. We had a wonderful, beautiful ceremony. It was up in Yosemite in the chapel there. And I had a handmade gown with French re-embroidered lace, and it was full length. It was off-white. And I wore these little gold lamé shoes. Now, the reason that I wore gold shoes is because this was actually the color of the ancient sacred prostitutes. And the only reason I knew that is because I had taken classes from a woman named Cozy Fabian. And Cozy Fabian taught these sacred prostitution classes in San Francisco. And she taught us that the colors of the ancient sacred prostitutes were gold and red. And so both my friend, Nikki, and I wore gold shoes when we got married. And they were just peeking under our white wedding gowns. So anyway, when I came home, my husband proceeded to make my life miserable. And he made my life miserable for, I'd say, at least a year. He very rarely had anything supportive to say about my work as a sex worker rights activist. And yes, I got involved in sex worker rights pretty early in my career as a sex worker. Started working with the organization called, it's called Coyote. It's kind of defunct now, but it was started in 1976 by Margo St. James. And it stands, it's an acronym that stands for Call Off Your Old Tired Ethics. So I was one of the original steering committee members for the Coyote that was rebirthed in San Francisco in the 90s. And we started getting all kinds of phone calls and letters from television producers. And I went out on one or two of those, and they just loved me. They absolutely loved me. So it was word of mouth. One producer would share my contact information with another producer, and pretty soon I was just doing TV shows right and left. I went on CNN 3 times, was on the Playboy Channel 3 times, did the Montel Williams show, did Geraldo a couple times, not him, just his show. was on a bunch of little shows, you know, like the Jane Whitney show, and I was on Maury Povich. God, I don't know. Anyway, Fox News, let's see, A&E did a special about me as a modern-day courtesan, and I wound up on the Politically Incorrect, Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, back when it was on ABC. I was there with Charo, John Schneider from Dukes of Hazzard, and Howie Mandel, back when he still had hair. And we actually had Michael Buffer announcing it. Michael Buffer does the Let's Get Ready to Rumble for all the boxing matches. Anyway, he announced our show that way. And we filmed it in Las Vegas, and we talked about legalizing prostitution. What else would you talk about in Las Vegas? So it was fun. It was a really, really fun show. That's probably my favorite TV show out of all the shows that I've ever done, was being on Bill Maher's show, because it was a comedy. It was fun. We had a party afterwards, and we went to Liberace's house. And anyway, so once I started doing all these TV shows, you know, this was actually kind of making what I did for a living even more obvious, obviously, and sometimes my husband would go to work and he'd get teased by the men who worked for him, because he was a manager, he was a sales manager for a telecommunications firm. And sometimes, you know, the men might have actually been watching the Playboy Channel and saw him having sex with me on the Playboy Channel. It was kind of difficult for him at work, and we started not getting invited to certain company events. You know, like the company party, they had to invite us to, but some of the other things that, you know, were being held at somebody's private home, and everybody from work went, they would just forget to invite us. And we had another friend, a married couple, who actually told us to our face, you're not invited to our house because of what she does for a living, she being me. So we lost some friends, and, you know, I have to say the fact that my husband didn't divorce me and that he stood by me says a lot about how much he loved me. And at the same time, it took some convincing for him to feel good about being married to a prostitute. And one of the things that I did is I finally decided that he was under a false impression about what it was I was giving the clients and what I was giving him. So I invited him to actually make an appointment with me and come see me as a client. And it was so funny because his eyes lit up and he looked all excited about it. I remember thinking, oh, my God, my husband actually thinks that whatever I'm doing, you know, for pay is probably better than what he's getting for free. And I thought, okay, well, he's going to find out that's not the case. So he came to the door with his money in hand. And he was all ready to pay me for sex, and I took his money, and I asked him to have a seat. I made a little chit-chat with him, just like we were meeting for the first time, because role-playing is something prostitutes get really good at. And then I went and I changed into my lingerie, and I came back out and invited him to relax while I gave him a massage. Then I worked my way to oral sex, and at some point he was hoping we'd kiss, and that didn't happen. And when I used a condom for the blowjob, that was very disappointing because, you know, he's used to having unprotected sex with me. And so then he started realizing that, wait a minute, even though you're really nice to me as a client, you're not in love with me. And pretty soon he was begging me to go back to, no, I don't want to be your client anymore. So that was basically how he got past that. And I think the other thing that he tells the story this way, that he had always been afraid that he was going to be outmatched in some way, that one of my clients would probably have more money than him, and one of my clients might have a bigger penis than he had, and that, you know, how do you get past the feeling of being threatened by that? And what he told himself was, of course they're going to have bigger wallets and bigger genitals Somebody out there's gonna. And so what? Not a single one of them will be him. And if I was truly in love with him, it really wouldn't matter. And that's exactly the truth. Because the more he became comfortable with allowing me to share the details of my work so that I would come home and I would tell him, you know, first I felt really comfortable telling him about the bad stuff. Okay, this client was boring, or, you know, he was a little control freak, or, you know, something about him. Maybe he had a bad smell, whatever. He gave me a bunch of ones, you know. Who does that? whatever the case was, I could bring home the complaints, and, you know, of course, that was easier to hear than maybe that something was great and wonderful about a client. But eventually, I got braver, and I started coming home to tell my best friend, my husband, my soulmate, about these wonderful clients. And some of these clients are absolutely astounding. I mean, we're talking about, you know, self-made millionaires. Absolutely, lots of those, more than I'll ever be able to count. But there were actually some billionaires in there, too. And people who were doing some amazing things. You know, like one of my clients was working on a cure for cancer. So really amazing people. And as I worked my way up to being a courtesan, which is a little different than somebody who does in-calls and out-calls, I was actually at this point traveling around the United States. They were flying me out to New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, down into Florida. Kansas City, I think I went to one time. That wasn't really exciting. But Princeton, New Jersey, I believe. That was actually quite beautiful. But I flew all around the U.S., oftentimes wearing a suit, you know, pinstripe suit, and carrying a briefcase. And that's how I traveled as a high-end escort. And I stayed in some of the nicest hotels, ate in some of the most amazing restaurants, and went to Broadway plays and museums, and really got pampered. I spent a lot of my time in day spas, getting hot rock massages, or shopping in Gucci boutiques. It really was. Pretty Woman doesn't even come close to touching what it was like. Pretty Woman was underpaid. But if you saw that movie with Julia Roberts and Richard Gere, all I can say is she was shortchanged. But anyhow, it was better than that, and it was amazing. And to be able to come home and tell my husband what an awesome time I was having and share my excitement with him, what that did was that positioned him as being my absolute best friend. And no matter how great of a time I was having with these amazing men, I couldn't wait to get home and tell my true love. So, you know, that's a really difficult one for people to wrap their minds around, usually. Usually that's a very difficult one, because it really violates most of our standards about marriage, and I'm well aware of that. But that's how it worked for us. How it worked for us was that we had complete disclosure and absolute honesty, and because of that, no matter how wonderful a time I was having, I was always missing him. Always missed him. So I guess that's what it's like to truly be in love. And I've been in love with my ex-husband since the day I met him. And I'm still in love with him today. I will probably be in love with him till the day I die. So at this point in my life, I realize it's possible to be in love with more than one person at a time. Or at least I entertain the possibility that it could be. I can't say that that's happened to me yet. So I don't know. Maybe it's possible for other people and not possible for me. Anyway, I start you off with a little bit of my biography here, and here's my intention. I hope that by disclosing things about myself that you not only find it entertaining, which most of my live audiences do. I'm going to be giving a similar spiel over at Sonoma State University this Friday, actually, because I speak at colleges and universities quite often, and I do workshops and all that. But aside from the entertainment value, I hope that you will also start to feel that you're building something of a relationship with me so that you can start to feel comfortable revealing things about yourself. Because that's really the objective about this radio show. I'm not so much interested in having a monologue here. I really do want to have a dialogue with you, and I hope that you will call in and, bring some of your questions about sex and relationships so that I can do what I do best, which is really help other people. I did that when I was escorting, and since my retirement in 2004, what I do now, I transitioned into being a full-time sex educator, a relationship coach, and I'm a certified sexologist, as well as being an author of a sex manual. So I work with people over the phone, and both men and women, and sometimes couples. It's a little more difficult working with couples over the phone because when I'm working with couples, I like to watch the body language of the part of the couple, the man or the woman, who's not doing the talking. And when you're working over the phone, there's dead silence, so not so much body language there. But anyway, I have started working with couples over the phone regardless of that, just following my intuition, and I have pretty good intuition, actually. It took me far and did well by me as far as being as an escort. And now that I work with people one-on-one over the phone, it's been quite helpful as well. So let's get to some of those questions that are listed up on the website right now. And if you happen to be over at the Shame Free Zone on bbsradio.com, you'll see some of those questions. And if you have some of your own, feel free to call in. And if I hear you beep in, I will stop what I'm doing and pick up your call. In the United States right now, that toll-free number is 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. And in Canada, the toll-free number is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. So the first question here we got here is, I'm horny, but I want to go to heaven. Help. And I think, really, to me, this question pretty much sums up the whole reason that I started the Shame Free Zone. I think we live in a society that is just so hammered with shame in general, and then sexual shame in particular. So there seems to be a real tug-of-war between our sensuality and our sexuality and our spirituality. And I'm all about getting those to be back together again as one. Where sex and spirit come together. If you go over to veronicamonet.com, you'll see that that's my message. Sex and spirit come together. Now, there's a lot of ways to accomplish that, but the first thing you have to do is really just try to figure out where some of your ideas come from. And most people haven't even examined assumptions. They don't even know what their assumptions are. So, my first recommendation is get a piece of paper out and just write out the first thing that comes to your mind. Is sex evil, or sex is good if you're married, or sex is allowed, or is it special? Okay, and what makes it special? Is it sacred? Okay, why is it sacred? When is it sacred? And if you write out your opinions about sex, you can start to get some leads on where the shame lives. Because if you just say, okay, yeah, I feel shame, most people are going to say, no, I don't feel any shame. I don't feel any sexual shame. I know sex is necessary and good, and God created it, and that's wonderful. And that's not going to really help you find your sexual shame. I really thought, after being on television for years and debating congressmen and feminists and all the things that I have weathered in the name of sexual freedom, I really didn't think I had any sexual shame. And one day I was having sex with my husband, and we were actually doing it doggy style, and he bent down and he whispered in my ear. He said, what I love about having sex with you is that you enjoy it so much. Now, I had no idea that I had a trigger around pleasure. So it was okay for me to be a prostitute. It was okay for me to get paid. It was okay for me to have had multiple sexual partners and to have been promiscuous. It was okay for me to have done all this stuff. But God forbid I should actually enjoy sex with my husband. If you had asked me, are you ashamed of that? I would have said, you must be crazy. So sometimes the only way you can find out where your shame is just to see when your body shuts down, when you find yourself holding your breath, when all of a sudden the pleasure leaves your body. You get to a certain point maybe where you feel like you're going to have this wonderful, beautiful orgasm, and then all of a sudden everything goes numb. Sometimes that's an indication that you've got shame around the whole idea of having too much pleasure. Now, we have some really strange ideas tucked away in the corner of our brains, and they're difficult to get to. Fortunately, that's something I'm pretty gifted at. One of my totem animals is the woodpecker. Actually, it is the totem animal that I ascribe to. And the woodpecker is all about digging underneath the bark, going in and finding what's hidden in underneath the top layers of bark. And I really identify that with that. I really do. So I have tools for how I go and find, search these things out in myself, and I have tools for how I'm able to go in and do this for other people. And I also use my intuition to do it. So anyway, what did I do when I realized that I had sexual shame around having pleasurable sex with my husband? Well, I went in quest of finding out more about shame and about sexual shame in particular, and then I actually just started teaching workshops about it because, you know, it's that whole thing. Sometimes you go teach the very thing that you need, and I realized that I needed to have more focus on this, so I started Freedom from Sexual Shame workshops, and I traveled around and gave those in California and up in the state of Washington and in Oregon, and I think I've actually taught it in Miami, Florida, too. I don't know. I'd have to check. But anyway, it's one of the workshops that I travel around and teach. And I've learned a lot from working with other people's sexual shame, too. So I'm horny, but I want to go to heaven. What that suggests to me is that basically, if I am to act out my sexuality and act upon my impulses of, you know, being sexually turned on, but somehow or another that's in conflict with a relationship with God. And I'm actually an ordained minister through the Universal Life Church. It's an online church. It's really non-denominational. I did that so I could marry friends, and I also did it so that I can talk to people without divulging their secrets. So I have some confidentiality there. According to the law, that's accorded reverence. And since I'm a reverend, I get to take advantage of that. Anyway, this particular person who had emailed me this about, I'm horny but I want to go to heaven, wanted to know how I reconciled, you know, being sex positive and believing in sexual freedom with being a minister. And, you know, first and foremost, it's because I don't ascribe to a particular religion. So I don't accept what's in the Bible as my guide for my value system. And I don't really accept any particular book. It really doesn't matter. I mean, I've studied Tantra. People who get into Tantra sometimes have a lot of rules and dogma around Tantra. And I'm pretty much about trying to find my own true, authentic path. And that's what I try to help my clients with. I try to help them find their true, authentic path. We're all different, and we're all at different stages in our life. And if something doesn't feel right for one person, it may feel right for another person. And there are stages in life, too. I mean, I haven't had sexual intercourse for over a year now. And that's not because I am trying to get to heaven. It's just because that's where I'm at. It has not been something I've wanted to have. I've really been going into Tantra. I've been using masturbation and meditation. I've been using conscious breathing techniques. I've had some kundalini awakenings around Kriya, all kinds of amazing things. And what I found is that intercourse sometimes was just kind of getting in the way of that exploration. So I just put it aside for a little bit so I could go off and explore some other things. But I don't have a value judgment on it. And neither do I set up arbitrary rules for myself like, I'm going to be abstinent for this amount of time. I really try to just have an organic approach to life. I might have sexual intercourse tomorrow. Who knows? I certainly have plenty of opportunities. But so far, I'm just saying no to those offers because they don't resonate with me right now. So that's sometimes a little surprising to people. That, you know, I actually believe that abstinence has a place in a healthy sex life. And at the same time, I think promiscuity can be a beautiful thing. If you are living right there in that moment of what's truly authentic for you, what's going on for you. But there's a lot of difficulty getting to that if you don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So being able to dig out the shame, the guilt, and find out what you truly need and what's really going on for you is a difficult thing. In the workshop that I teach about sexual shame, I have several recommendations, and of course I have exercises that I take people through. But one of the recommendations that I have is first of all, I invite people to study sex history. Now, that's not something you usually get in school, and it's not even something you get in college. But if you email me or give me a call, I will be happy to direct you to some resources where you can familiarize yourself with the history of sex. It's really rich and varied, and what it does is it kind of gets rid of some of the mystique about a lot of times we are told, oh, things are getting worse and people are more perverse than ever. It's kind of like when you study the history of sex, you realize nobody's really invented anything new sexually for a long time. So whatever's going on today was pretty much going on thousands of years ago. And that kind of puts it in perspective so that you realize that even your grandparents were doing things. Now, maybe not your grandparents, but somebody's grandparents, trust me, were doing things that you might think are modern or really, you know, out there. They've been doing this stuff forever. So there's really nothing new under the sun sexually unless it involves batteries or an electrical plug-in of some sort. So that's one. History gives you some perspective so that when you hear people say things like it's not natural or it's always been done this way, then you can basically refute that and just know that that's probably not true. The other thing is to build community. So I really think it's important to know where there are other communities of people who are exploring other ways of being. So let's say you're into BDSM. That's an acronym for bondage, discipline, sadomasochism. And it sounds really scary, but the fact of the matter is that some of the more tame versions of that are like, you know, tying your lover's wrists up with a scarf or putting a blindfold on or maybe, you know, spanking your girlfriend's ass while you're having doggy-style sex with her. This is something a lot of people do, and these are considered mild forms of BDSM. Obviously, there's some pretty sophisticated stuff that you can get into, and the more advanced forms actually require training because they're very potentially dangerous, and if you don't know what you're doing, you can damage yourself permanently, if not kill yourself. So that's actually something I have never considered myself a dominatrix, but I've done quite a few advanced things in the world of BDSM, and then there's a whole bunch of advanced things I've never done and probably will never get the nerve to do. But it can be a fun way of experimenting. And maybe you're interested in exploring polyamory. Maybe you have wondered if one person is really the way to go for you. Maybe monogamy, you know, feels kind of artificial or awkward, and you're wondering if people are really meant to be monogamous. There are lots of groups out there who are polyamorous, and they have conventions and workshops and meets and greets and, you know, little getaways and retreats and all kinds of stuff. And if you get connected with those people, then you start to realize that you're a very normal human being too, and then you don't feel so odd and so isolated. So community is important, history is important, and then of course finding one person that you can really trust to share your deepest, darkest secrets with, because this is something that, unfortunately, the way our culture is set up, most people have been keeping sexual secrets for their entire life. And, you know, it starts when we're kids, when we're masturbating, and we're feeling ashamed of that because perhaps we were told that we shouldn't touch ourselves down there. Or maybe our parents came in on us and opened the door and caught us, and then their response was one of complete horror and embarrassment. And because of the way they reacted to it, we felt, you know, shamed and horrified ourselves. And sometimes that can have a huge impact on your sexual function. So if you can talk about those things and with somebody who's trustworthy and is not going to shame you, this can have a really beautiful healing effect. And unfortunately, some of the people out there that you might want to go talk to about your sexual shame are not always the best audience. There's lots of licensed therapists who are still mired in their own sexual shame and really can't bring that kind of absolution, if you will. They can't really give you a shame-free zone because they're not shame-free. And, you know, it's one thing to have some sexual shame and know where it is and to be working on that, and it's quite another to be completely oblivious and think that you don't have a problem. Pretty much, I look at sexual shame as this. It's just like racism. If you say you're not racist, you probably got a big problem with it, because the people who are more honest are going to be able to find those pockets of racism and just, you know, be acquainted with it and go, okay, I'm not perfect, and I do have some assumptions and stereotypes. And it's the same thing with sexual shame. If you're pretty much thinking, I don't have any sexual shame, I would challenge that and say, you might want to take a second look at that. Because usually, if you grew up on planet Earth, you got a little bit of sexual shame somewhere, because it would just be really difficult to go through life without getting inculcated with it. I went to one of the most remote places on the planet, Papua New Guinea. It was the last place to be colonized by white men on this planet, and I think that was back in the 50s, and I visited on a scuba diving expedition in the 90s, and those people used to run around, you know, topless and bottomless, and they were very phallic. They worshipped the penis and had all this beautiful art, phallic art. But after the missionaries got done with them, they are running around with all kinds of sexual shame now, too. And the first thing they'll say to you is, I've given my heart to the Lord. So, and they're all wearing, you know, T-shirts, and they're all covered up. And as a matter of fact, I had to dress more conservatively to go to that country than I do over here in the United States. So sexual shame is pretty much everywhere. And who cares? Well, it's really unhealthy to be cut off from your sexuality. If you are going to be abstinent, you want to do it from a place of choice, not a place of shame. So we're about out of time for this show, and just to give you a heads up on the next episode, I am probably going to finish telling you a little bit about my personal journey, because I've pretty much only worked up to telling you about how I got my husband to accept the fact that I was working as a prostitute. Never even mentioned the fact that I had stepkids or going to jail or any of that stuff, so next week I can cover some of that, and then we'll get on to another question here. And maybe we'll talk about premature ejaculation, or I don't know, maybe I'll be in the mood to talk about my boyfriend cheated on me. But we'll work our way through some of these questions, and then when you get the courage to reach out and ask me one of your own, I will be delighted to be there for you. Okay, so just be sure, if you do have any questions after listening to this, you are so welcome to come over to sexwithoutshame.com and find out what it is I can do for you. Or you can just call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. That's my toll-free number, and that phone is there all the time. I usually answer it from 10 to 10 Pacific time, Monday through Friday. And the number again is 888-903-0050. And just one parting thought about masturbation. A lot of people think that, you know, since we were talking about, that's where sexual shame can often start. I just want to leave you with this thought. A lot of boys and girls started masturbating before they were born. So if it's something that is happening in utero, before you even have your first breath of air, your first bite of food, your first sip of mother's milk, it must be a good thing. I just can't imagine that that would be a bad thing. That's it. I'm out of here. Good night, and I hope to talk to you next week.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me.
He tried to tell her, and she thought it right. Hand in hand, they marched on through the night. He knew the answers she'd hoped to find. It'll just take a little time.